This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Matthew Sanford. He's an author and yoga teacher based in Minnesota. I spoke with him on July 7th, 2006, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. This interview is included in our show, The Body's Grace. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Yeah, for
which
sure.
Is
yeah.
Just coming straight into your ears.
Right. No,
in fact,
sure.
I think for me now, I've gotten so used to that. You know, I close my eyes and I'm just totally present to the voice and just the voice.
Because it's sensual in those earphones, yeah.
And
you can close your eyes.
And also, like, I don't have to sit up straight or, you know, I don't know. I don't have to have my eyes open.
We can use it. I can turn the other way. I'll do whatever you need.
No, it's just that it's more labor intensive to do one this way, but it's also sometimes really the best way to do it. So it's a mix. So I think that's what I wanted to tell you. Just we just are talking.
Okay.
And that's really what we're doing.
Okay.
And Mitch, what do you need? Do you need more of Matthew's voice?
Maybe just what he had for breakfast.
What did you have for breakfast? Just start with something mundane.
What did I have for breakfast?
Yeah,
today?
What did you have for breakfast? You thought you were going to get a deep question.
A fried egg. And a fried egg this morning with lots of pepper.
You know,
I like pepper.
Better than most people I ask that question. It's really shameful. Yeah, my guests don't eat breakfast or lunch.
Yeah, I didn't used to. I started as I get a little older. And it's like, I can't go as long without eating.
How old is your son now?
He's 6.
Oh, he is.
Just finished kindergarten, going into first grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Krista? We're good. I just need you to remember nodding is better than saying uh-huh.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and we're rolling.
The other thing I have to remember when we're live is I can't say uh-huh, which I'm tempted. I can do on the phone. I just have to nod a lot. So that's what Mitch was reminding me. You know, a lot of people have a good story, or a lot of people I'm talking with, even about a theme, their story is the backdrop, and I don't always think the way to do the interview is to have them tell the story, but I actually think with you, I think the story is the framework, and, you know, I want to jump in and ask you questions about what certain things mean and conclusions you've drawn about big subjects, but I really think I just want to start with having you talk about what happened to you in your life that changed you so much, your accident.
I mean, the actual details?
Well, just...
I struggle with this question because everyone does, and I end up kind of giving a litany of, here's what happened, blah, blah, blah. But
well, just start the story, and we'll see where it takes us. But how old were you when you were in the car accident?
I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I was sleeping in the car when it happened. So one of the reasons why it's called waking is it literally was waking to another life. We were traveling from Kansas City, Missouri on the Sunday after Thanksgiving because we spent Thanksgiving every year down with my mom's sister. And we were driving home and it was 31 degrees and misty and it seemed like a harmless day. And we were coming up on a bridge and hit a patch of ice, preferential icing. You hear about that in driver's ed. I didn't really know what that really was. But we just slid off the embankment, tumbled front to back 3 times in the car. My father and sister were killed. My mother and brother, my brother just jammed his shoulder, and my mother got a bruise on her face, on her eyes. And I was, but broke a lot of things, broke my back and my neck, both my wrists. I filled a lung with fluid and sustained an injury to my pancreas that didn't allow me to eat for about 3 months, 2.5 months. So pretty about as banged up as you can be on an accident.
And it was pretty clear early on that you would be paralyzed, partially paralyzed, right?
Well, yeah. You know, I was in a coma, so I was out of it for 3.5 days. When I woke up, pretty soon, I was told pretty quickly what happened. But what was so interesting about that, you know, is that I was 13. I could hardly process really what happened, you know, like
anyway, I mean, you'd lost your father and your sister.
It's kind of like getting the weather reported to you, you know, like your father, you know, Laura and Dad are gone. And really what was interesting about it is that I saw right away that my remaining family, they were desperate and they needed me to live. And it was a great way for me to attach to something living. So, you know, trauma happens not just to an individual, it happens to a whole community, to a family. And a lot of those initial early times was me connecting to my family and thinking, oh, I need to live for them right away, which I think was a healing story to myself.
You talk about healing stories in your memoir, and you talk about healing stories all the way through life. I mean, the way you use that term, I think that it would also apply to people in the midst of many experiences, which wouldn't include necessarily physical illness or physical challenges. And you did write that your first healing story was just, and it's often a line, right, that your mother and your brother needed you to live.
It was a way for me to not feel how injured I was. In fact, going back at it, hearing my mom tell me that the doctors told her that it's good he doesn't know how injured he is, that we took advantage of my innocent 13-year-old energy still going towards life, that I didn't think so much about how injured I was. I never honestly ever really considered not surviving. Like, I didn't really think, oh gosh, I wasn't that aware, you know, that I wasn't that aware of the possibility of my own death so much at 13. But the healing story things, one of the things I really try to get across with all that I do is that we all have traumas and we all have our own stories. And I try to write the story in a way that makes the reader think about their own experience. This concept you're talking about of healing stories, I think it applies all the place. We're constantly losing our trust in the world. You know, things happen, you know, even loss of childhood innocence, anything, you know, death of a loved one, where suddenly the world changes its shape and you have to confront how are you going to connect back to the world. And we tell healing stories all the time. And, you know, you hear people that are generally positive, you know, or people that always are kind of thinking that the world's doing them wrong. I would call them those healing stories, that they've got a very good healing story.
But can healing stories also be negative?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think healing stories can definitely be negative. And in fact, some of them can be good at the time. Like, for example, for the first few years after I was injured, I was told, I would often be asked, well, how'd you get through everything you got through? And my answer would be, well, I've had two lives. I had one end at 13. My life as a walking person ended at 13. And I've had this second life, so it's actually, I'm kind of getting two lives. Well, that was a very smart healing story because I had to put away at first the childhood love of my body and trying to confront this new reality, so that positing a discontinuity.
You just closed a door. And,
yep.
Yeah.
And went on to the next one. And that was, at the time, exactly what I needed to say. Healing stories, I believe, always have an element of truth to them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they don't have an element of truth, they're just rationalizations. There's a whole other category of things that we tell ourselves. But you end up closing one door, and it allowed me to focus on adult-like considerations, and I needed it. However, eventually through the practice of yoga, is that I needed to reconnect to the boy that loved his body, too. Mm-hmm. I needed to have all my ages. And the process of doing yoga allowed me to reconnect with the boy that's really disappointed about what happened to my body and what happened to my life. But that's, I needed to recover that. So often I think healing stories themselves require healing over time.
And so when you had to grieve, and it's almost like you had to grow into the stage where you could grieve at different levels. And then you also talk about it, your body grieved at different stages in different ways. Tell some of that, because, you have this... I don't want to use, you know, insight into your own body. That's too mild. You're in touch with your body. All these phrases are kind of cliched, but you know things about your body. You've had to live with it more intimately through, by way of the fact that it was damaged.
For sure. And part of that was that I had to, I mean, the overt connections between my mind and my paralyzed body, the ones that are most easy and most efficient, aren't here anymore.
Which is that
the spinal cord.
I think a thought and I don't know that I'm thinking. My hand is gesturing because I'm animated in this conversation.
Right.
Right.
But same with your toes. Or you might be pressing and wiggling your toes at
the
same time.
I'm shaking my foot, which I do.
I mean, that's just part of, the connection between your mind's intent and your body is so intimate they seem as one. Mm-hmm. Well, that connection got changed in my case. So I've had to pursue a lot of the subtler connections between mind and body. That's the foundation of my yoga practice. And so what ends up happening with me is that I have to go inward and listen to levels that we all share. You have the same connections in your mind-body relationship that I use to do yoga and that I use in the rest of my life. And I believe that we need those connections I'm forced to do them. I'm trying to reconnect my body.
Right, because your more easy, obvious connections were severed. And I think the rest of us often, I don't have to go there. I don't have to seek those subtle connections.
One of the big healing things for me was to recognize that my paralyzed body didn't stop talking to my mind. It changed its voice. It went to a more subtle whisper that doesn't have as much clarity. It's sweeter, it's quieter, and it doesn't as quickly react. So I call that, I try to describe it as energetic presence. Like if you were to squeeze my ankle, I feel like you're squeezing a tube of toothpaste. I can feel the surge up my body through my spine. Like those are all, there's a subtle body that we have here.
But you feel it as energy rather than as nerve endings.
Right. It's not as loud. It's not as crisp. Mm-hmm. It's more, for me, it's also very auditory. And I don't know if that is because because I'm just auditory, like that's how my brain's wired, or, you know, I don't know if I were more a visual person, but I inwardly listen and hear. I pay attention and I can feel these changes. But, you know, at the same time, it's a lot easier for me to get distracted. If I'm really nervous, I don't hear these levels as well. If I'm at a rock concert, mm-hmm. I don't hear it at all, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. they're, it takes some attention. And if you focus too much on it, you can amplify it to the point of exaggeration. You know, so it's not as efficient. It's not, I mean, there's a reason why people like me weren't surviving 2 million years ago. This probably isn't great for survival when you're getting chased by tigers.
Right. I want to talk about yoga and go there and the mind-body connection, but I do want to dwell just for a little while longer with
I like that part better. The yoga to me is just my particular story.
Yeah.
I wrote the book, and I tell my story because I want to show something about the mind-body relationship. Mm-hmm. Not because I want you to know something about me or about what I do with yoga.
Yeah, I know, but it's happened in your life. I mean, your life is a container for that.
Right.
And the flip side of this, what you're describing that you've learned over these years, how many years?
15 years since I started yoga.
Is that you had real experiences, as you say, of leaving your body mm-hmm. early on, not only after the accident, but just through excruciating rehabilitation and other operations that followed. And, I mean, tell me about that.
It's so interesting because there's one experience in particular that happened to me soon, right when I got to the Mayo Clinic, that I call an overt out-of-body experience, although I don't know what really happened. I was drugged when it happened. I don't know if I really was watching from above. But I had some screws twisted into my skull to stabilize my broken neck. And I was not, I was watching what was happening below. And what was revealed to me in that instance, and I realized more in retrospect as I've gotten older, is that I got shown something there about the fluctuation and movement that can happen between mind and body. And that insight, that there isn't the crisp boundaries that we think there are, or that it's all the same, that I got shown that, what we think is all a tight knot is actually much more loose. And so that insight got revealed to me early. And what ends up happening to me through the first 3 months, where there's a lot of corrective violence, you know.
Right.
People don't get that. Hospitals are a violent place.
Right.
It's all good, and I wouldn't be here without it.
Yeah.
Corrective violence, we had to counteract what happened to me. But
you had to have your wrists broken again because they healed incorrectly.
And the spine straightened and all the things that, like, literally. But, you know, when you take a knife and cut someone open, even if you're using anesthesia, it's still really hard on the body. But what I did is I learned how intuitively, this wasn't like a conscious thing so much, it was a little bit conscious near the end, is that I learned how to disassociate from my body, that I learned how to move away from it to avoid pain. But one of the things that I think, my story, I think, is just more extreme. I think that we do that all the time through the course of our day. Mm-hmm. When we're daydreaming, you know, when we're just kind of not paying attention and kind of off somewhere else, that we have that capability within our mind-body relationship, within our consciousness. And that I got shown that really early and in really dramatic fashion. And the question then became for me was when I encountered then, after I start to feel better and am aware enough, I'm still in the hospital, but I'm aware enough to, what's going on here? I was being told over and over that I didn't have sensations. My sensation in my paralyzed body was over. And I kept to the doctors. I'd say, well, yeah, but I feel stuff. I feel tingling and kind of burning and itching. And, you know, that's not exactly all the way gone. Yeah. And they were really worried that I think that would be helping me walk again, that that would be like somehow my spine's regenerating, that the only healing they were focused on was like, if my spine couldn't regenerate, then the rest is just going to be lost. And those sensations, listening to my own experience, ends up being those sensations I were told weren't real then at 13. And I believed. I mean, you're only 13. You believe the adults around you. Mm-hmm. I mean, the innocence.
And you believe doctors. All of us believe doctors.
We all believe doctors.
Yeah.
And they weren't good, and they're well-intending. But what ends up happening is that level of mind-body connection is not one that we recognize here. It ended up being the cornerstone of my yoga practice. Mm-hmm. But like, I think, getting back to your question, that I got shown something early in those early experiences. And what I only figured out over time was that it isn't just the ability to disassociate. I mean, we kind of all know that. We kind of, you know, we know that kids were abused as children, can't remember, and that's just something that we can do. But what I found that was so amazing was the silence mm-hmm. that I experienced in those experiences. And then for me, with my particular injury being a mind-body injury at core, it's got a physical cause, but the real injury I live with is that my mind has a harder time being in my body than yours does. Mm-hmm. That was a form of silence too. That literally a level of silence or absence of normal sensation, silence got infused into my mind-body relationship. But I think that's happening to all of us. I think that's aging. That like our mind-body relationship is changing over time.
I want you to talk about the term silence. You use it a lot in your mm-hmm. book. I mean, there are many wonderful line, evocative lines. I mean, here's one. The silence is the aspect of our consciousness that makes us feel slightly heavy. It is the source of our feeling of loss, but also of a sense of awe. In another place, you're talking about your dealing with physicians, and you say this silence demands grace, not rupture. But really talk to me about what that silence is, because you're using the word in a completely particular way to your to your experience.
Not an easy question.
No,
because
I know.
I've been trying to define
it
many,
word.
Many
it's
times.
It's a big word, the way you use it.
But part of what I try to do is make it seem more ordinary. When I do compare it to our experiences, when you're watching your dishes for another day, you know, after another meal, and you have that kind of quiet feeling, I think that silence, I think we all know what I'm talking about. You can kind of feel it when you feel beauty.
It's the silence within us.
Mm-hmm. And that literally, I mean, you could say it all sorts of ways. They're all different, and I would call them healing stories about how to get this out about our experience. I mean, think about one that doesn't light me up, but we're 90% empty space. Like literally what we think is full and embodied has a lot of empty space in it already. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a dimension, like for example, you know, when you learn to soften your organs of perception, let's say if I were to ask you right now to soften the inside of your mouth and in particular relax your tongue, something will happen to your perception inward in your body and you will hear something different. The world will suddenly get a little quieter. You'll feel a different kind of presence in you. That's what I mean by silence. And I do think it's an ordinary experience. I think that we have it all the time. We just don't recognize it. I think that's where stress lands. Hmm. I think that there's an invisible aspect of our consciousness that's here that we need to manage better. We need to be more present with for a lot of reasons. Because I think this same silence, and this is the paradoxical insight that guides all my work, is that silence we're talking about both connects us to other people and separates. Mm-hmm. It goes either way.
And I mean, the way I understand it, it also goes towards life or towards death.
It is both. You know what I mean? It's not like the silence can only go towards life. In fact, I kind of think that level of absence that we carry within us that I'm calling silence is itself some level of dying or death that we carry within us. And so it's not that the silence can go away from it. I think in trying to listen, for example, to the silence of my paralysis, that it itself has texture, that it itself has life in it. And it's a kind of life that mixes. Mm. You know, it's like in a yoga pose, for example, you try to make what I would say the silence congruent with physical exertion. Mm. not just physically exert with a lot of will, but trying to be aware enough to have all your spaces. To think about what you can feel in your body. You only feel a little portion of it. If I were to ask you to stretch your intercostal muscles right now, you wouldn't exactly know how to do that. Yeah. Like, you have silence too in your mind-body relationship. If I were to ask you to lift your inner the arches of your feet directly, you wouldn't be able to do that. If you were to try to go there, you would encounter a wall, a brick wall. And now the question is it just a brick wall? Or if you start to listen and to be quiet, you can start hearing that brick wall. It isn't just a wall. It's a different quality of awareness that's residing within you, that in that silence, sounds can gain texture again. And I say in one place in the book, the moon might reveal itself, life reveal itself again, only darker. And I compare it to walking from a well-lighted room into a dark one, and that at first you can't see anything. But if you sit and you pause and you listen, usually there's enough light to get across the room. Usually there's just enough in there. You know, it's not going to be like turning the light back on. But in fact, the world gets this other kind of texture that makes it beautiful. It also makes it scary in the dark. You know, it goes either way. Does that help? I'm still working on this science. I'll keep going back at
it. No, it's great. tell me, embody it by telling me a couple of stories of when you, how you became aware of the silence.
Or when I started to see it my body. See, that was one of the big breakthroughs that came to me through yoga, is that in a way I was aware of the silence. You know, I still am. I mean, I've had a set of experiences in my life, and it's not just the car accident. There's a lot of trauma going through my story in the last 27 years. And it makes me feel separated. I feel a little bit like I've got a set of experiences that make me different than other people. I feel that separation, that gulf between, I mean, a lot of my close friends are now reading The Waking for the first time, and knowing that I went through stuff that they're shocked at, that's always been between me and them. Mm-hmm. That there's been a gulf between us. That silence has always been there. But I think we all feel that. We all feel individuals. I mean, there's a whole movement of existentialism. It talks about the radical separation of the individual from everything else.
Right.
I think they're describing some of the same stuff that they're trying to put in context and into story, an experience that we all have, where we all move.
But I think that what's happened to you is that with yoga in particular, you're kind of staring that straight on, and not accepting it as a wall or as a separation.
And to get to the practical answer to your question is that when I started to do yoga, there was a time where I knew I could feel stuff. I could feel the first time I met my yoga teacher. I was so lucky.
Tell me that story about how you came to meet her or be doing this. Did you know you wanted to do yoga?
No, I was having lots of pain in my body because my body has a lot of pain in it. I was at a body work and she says, "Why don't you try yoga?" And it turned out that it had been the case that when I was little, my dad had been in a car accident and got whiplash and tried to do some out of a book. So as a 5-year-old, I used to watch him before I was in kindergarten. I used to watch him do this stuff all by himself, and so I knew of it a little bit. But then when she said, "Why don't you try yoga?" I thought, well, you know, I knew I wanted to be more in my body. I knew that I had lived a healing vision where I tried to overcome my paralyzed body, had to overcome my disability, kind of get my arms strong and drag my body through life.
Right.
And that it had a consequence of making me feel way disconnected. And I know I needed to try something. And so I tried yoga because I thought, well, a 4,000-year-old discipline that's about integrating mind, body, and spirit seemed like a good place to start. but then I got extraordinarily lucky. The first teacher I met, Joe Zukovich, that relationship, I know I would not be where I am now and been able to stick with it. I also hadn't had an extraordinary personal relationship with my yoga teacher and her family. They kind of just took me in because it was hard. Because I had a lot of things when I was first starting yoga, a lot of, like I said, I was asleep in the car. I had no memory of that day at all. I had a lot of post-traumatic flashbacks, a lot of where I was encountered that my body
had
memory.
And that body had stored it, right?
Had stored it. And in fact, that I had left my body to avoid the pain. But what I had done is made my body absorb it alone. So as I started to reconnect to my body, I had to reconnect to the fact that not only was it conscious, in a way that I hadn't thought was even possible.
Yeah.
I was in graduate school studying the mind-body problem and consciousness, and I thought I knew what I was doing, and suddenly my experience throws at me that my body's conscious in a way that it's got memory.
Your body was alert to that
the
car
whole thing.
Accident.
Like, I don't have any visual memory of that day. I can feel the skid off the bridge. I can feel where the blow came from. I can feel when my lung was collapsed and I had trouble breathing. I can feel that angst. It's all in my body, and I can't see any of it. It's all in my body. And so I had to change.
It's like a physical narrative rather than an
exactly.
oral narrative.
And it completely changed my life, where I went, I always had kind of sensed that. But what's ended up happening, and this gets back to your earlier question, is that what ends up happening is that silence that I used to disconnect, I start to realize is embodied in my paralysis. And that the paralysis is itself a teacher of presence to me. And I compare it in the book to an artichoke. If you take an artichoke and you pull, as you eat an artichoke, you pull off leaf after leaf, thriving muscle off of my outer body, off of my legs after muscle, and eventually you get to the heart of the artichoke. That's what I think I experience in my paralysis. I experience what existence would be like before toil, before action. Like, this is what it is when it just hums. And to whatever extent I can feel and intuit that, which I call energetic awareness or sensation, I'm getting a glimpse into a level of existence that we have a hard time hearing. And that's part of why I came back to tell my story. That for me, writing Waking was, I wrote it to show something about the mind-body relationship, but I realized in the process of writing that it's a homecoming of sorts for me. Mm-hmm. I got knocked off the road, and I'm coming back to the group going, hey, look, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's some in the silence, there's some really neat stuff.
You use this phrase about how in yoga, first of all, you do, you practice Iyengar yoga,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, it sounds to me, from the way I read the story, you kind of happened upon this teacher who happened to teach Iyengar yoga.
Oh.
I mean, there are many forms of yoga, but this one is about alignment and precision, which seems
is what
perfectly
I need.
Suited to you with your spine.
And also, it focuses on each individual pose, right? Instead of sequences that have to go together.
Yeah.
So Mr. Iyengar, he's alive in Pune, India still. He reveals the universe of yoga in each individual pose. There's a level of depth and precision to it that's mind-boggling. But it was exactly what I needed because I could only do and start off with a few poses.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see the whole depth and clarity of yoga right away because Each yoga posture, regardless of what it is, have developed, I think, over time because they seal energy or they make it resonate through the mind-body relationship. The particular positions make it flow differently. I can feel that. That's how I can teach you yoga if you wanted to do yoga, is that I can feel that energy flow.
Right, and there's where you have this, because the doctors will tell you that you don't have sensation mm-hmm. in your legs, right? But you say, my mind can feel into my legs.
Yeah.
What's that like?
If you're really, really tired and you finally get into bed and you have that sinking feeling, you're laying there and you feel that relief and you feel like you're falling, even though you're just laying there, you keep falling because you're so tired. That level of dropping into your body and feeling, like if you were to take that experience and start listening then to your body from that level, that's what I think it is. Mm-hmm. That there's it's a landing, it's a grounding, it's a feeling of embodiment. There's a reason why when my son, he's six, is crying, he needs a hug. It's not just that he needs my love, he needs boundary around his experience. He needs to know that the pain is contained and can be housed, you know, and won't be limiting his whole being, that he gets a hug and he drops into his body. And when you drop into your body, paradoxically, typically pain is less.
Hmm.
That it's when pain gets more intense and more.
When you're afraid and try to keep it at bay.
And pull out of it, it really denies freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That when you, and it's a great short-term strategy. That's what I did as a 13-year-old. I pulled out of my body to get it, but it's a short-term strategy. And a lot of the process of my life is like embodying again and letting in, surrounding what's going on so I can be part of the world.
So, you know, I want to talk about how the way you've lived with what happened to you with limited use of, you know, all your limbs. I mean, obviously you had different stages of how you, what your healing stories were, what you were aspiring to. And you've mentioned this as well. You've touched on this as you've been speaking. I think our culture tends to like heroes. It tends to have phrases like beating the odds and conquering and being victorious. And I'm sure you wouldn't want to, you know, diminish, you know, the example of somebody like Christopher Reeves. But, you know, that was an example of someone for whom healing was only going to be reversing what had happened to him.
And that would be a perfect example of a healing story. And I think that's a very pervasive one in our culture.
Yeah.
And when it comes to healing, when it comes to a whole bunch, and then comes to aging, we admire that 80-year-old guy that runs a marathon.
Yeah.
You know, we want to see that proof that mind can overcome matter, because matter is the one that's going to be the end game, right? The body's going to be what ends up shutting down, right? And so, but what
we don't think of it that way, though,
right.
Or we think that if we have the will, and then we can technology will back us up, right?
And that's part of the healing story.
Okay.
What my life has been an exploration of, and believe me, I didn't get this right away. I mean, I broke my leg doing yoga. You know,
because you were trying to.
Oh,
be
I was
heroic,
all
right?
Of a sudden, I wanted to do the poses and like show how much I could do, and whack.
Stretch it to the limit.
And I unfortunately had to not, you know, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. I had to break a bone again before I learned nonviolence, right?
You mean nonviolence to your body?
To my body. That I needed to realize that, that was a whole huge insight into the nature of yoga and into the nature of one of the yamas, which is nonviolence. But, you know, getting back, what my story is a story about is realizing that you need all kinds of strength. That overcoming, you know, sometimes you got to do that. You got a deadline in your life and you work for 20 straight hours. That's what you do, right? And that's one story, but that's not what's going to sustain. That you need to be able to also, and it's overused. And I'm now, just now, after 15 years of yoga, understand this word deeper and deeper. And that is surrender, that you need to have the strength that comes from the silence. Because that is actually what saved my life as a 13-year-old. That silence I let in and allowed me not to feel my body, and it made me stronger and more resilient in a way, but not because I was flexing muscles. The silence itself is sinewy. It's got a strength to it and a fiber to it, that there's that kind of strength. And it comes from being more present, surrendering into the world, feeling more. But I don't mean intellectually. I mean literally having your body, letting it, like as if you're getting hugged like my son. Mm. It has that like, feeling. That is really strong. But your heart feels vulnerable when you let yourself be in the world like that. That's why we avoid it. It makes you feel vulnerable too. You know, that the kind of strength I'm talking about that has guided a lot of my exploration makes you feel oh so vulnerable and makes you have to feel more.
And, I mean, in your story, there were times when you, one stage of your understanding of this and your grappling with it was to decide that you still had the use of the upper half of your body and that you would make that as strong as possible and you would live in that part of your body and kind of declare the rest of it gone.
That's how I was guided to believe, in my opinion.
Right. And did you in fact feel more invulnerable when you had made that kind of declaration? I mean, what you just described about...
I think I was less aware.
Yeah.
You know, did I feel invincible? No, only because I broke my back my neck again a year after the accident, and was a quadriplegic for a while. So I always felt really vulnerable, that my physical body could break at any time. But that idea of being willful and being able to attack any problem with a lot of will,
yeah.
That makes you feel a type of control over the world.
Yeah.
That can make you feel less vulnerable. But for me, my life lessons have had such a paradoxical lesson. I mean, I also know the unthinkable is possible, that no matter what you do, you know. So that kind of story, and that's part of why I ended up probably doing yoga, is that on some level, that healing story of overcoming my disability, of dragging my body through life, I had already had an example that had made me see or opened me to the fact that the unthinkable is happening. You can have as much control as you want, but the world is so big. Life does its own thing with us on some level.
You know what's so interesting? The phrase, I think all the language around something like the mind-body connection is a little bit loaded, just like a lot of the language around religion and spirituality can sound new agey. And I mean, you had the experience with physicians that you did yoga and they thought of you as new agey. And I think part of that is just a language problem. But what you're pointing out is that a lot of the culture's glorification of will and triumphing by determination, that's also a form of mind-body connection. You know,
we're a form
asserting,
of integration.
We're asserting the mind-body connection without calling it that.
Right. That it's a form of integration. Dominance over bodies is what human beings have done for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Whether it be nature, whether it be each other, it's a form of mind-body integration. If I have a religion that I want you to believe, our history shows us that you can try to conquer the people and see if they'll have to accept the belief. That's mind-body integration. There's that level. And that it's my whole point is that we also need, that's one thing we want in the tool belt, to use will when you need to have it. But we, I think, are just on the beginning of realizing that there are many other ways to integrate with body. And in fact, I believe our human survival over time is going to depend on us getting much more subtly aware of bodies, much not just our own, the earth, each other, that we need to start studying, and we need stories mm-hmm. that help us see that there's depth and potential in what we're already experiencing. And that's part of why I started telling my story, is to try to get that across.
And even in bodies that don't function with the perfection to which we aspire, which in fact is a fallacy, and I mean, aging is an example of that as well.
And also, I also specialize in adapting yoga to people with disabilities.
Right.
And one of my, it makes me love yoga so much more. Yoga can travel through anybody. It's not about the perfect pose. It's not that. It's like literally, it's a phenomena that occurs at your mind's intent and your body's limits, and it kind of poof, it happens, and it travels through anybody. One of my favorite things is to have a yoga teacher come to my adaptive class, because what it does is it you have this faith in yoga, and you know on some level that it's not just about being able to do these incredible poses, but then you see it in three-dimensional form what's going on. That, like, literally, I believe working with neurological deficit, one of the big things for me was recognizing, I thought when I first started teaching adaptive yoga, that's why I started teaching first, I thought, well...
And adaptive yoga means?
Just adapting yoga poses and whatever you can to allow or have someone that lives with not as able a body.
For whatever is physically possible.
Right, to do mm-hmm. whatever they can do with yoga. Adapting it to someone who doesn't have as easy of a mind-body relationship.
Right.
And it's not just physical, it can be cognitive too. You know, they some people have that disability too, obviously. But that you see in class, you see the principles. Let me back up for a second. What I wanted to say is I thought I was giving back. Like, I had this knowledge with yoga that I needed to help, you know, I needed to give somewhere. And so I thought to help people with disability, no one would question that, because I'd had some remarkable things happen in what I could do, but also how I was feeling, you know, within my disability. But what I thought I was teaching them, and what I realized is that neurological deficit is the frontier of mind-body integration. And I don't need to go in with yoga and try to fix somebody or reverse their condition. But in fact, it struck me, there's an analogy, I think, with the development of 20th century psychology, that if you think about, like, Freud and Jung, as they're developing theories of the psyche, they work on neurosis and psychosis. They study those aberrant psychological states, and then they start to theorize, right? That the analogous group for mind-body integration is neurological deficit, whether it be cognitive or physical, right? That, like, literally here you have mind struggling through body. Because think about someone who's disabled. Pretty much on some level, the core injury is that their mind can't quite make it through their body.
Right, that connection is severed.
With the same kind of clarity.
Yeah.
And what's important about teaching someone with a disability or helping someone with a disability is that what they're already doing, the things that some of my students already do just to live their everyday life are themselves miraculous solutions to a mind-body problem. It's not like, oh, do it this way is better. You better make sure you understand why they're moving the way they're moving, what problem it's solving, seeing, and then makes you just go, oh my goodness, there's so much ingenuity in the human mind-body relationship. And then you try to help them do it with not so much will, that there's another connection between minds and bodies. So it's actually applied, everything I've been saying so far, it's really applied in a pressure cooker to mind-body relationships when you teach it with people with disabilities.
I want to ask you about something you wrote. I have never seen anyone truly become more aware of his or her body without also becoming more compassionate. What's that about? What's that? Why is that?
Well, it's just true. It's an observation.
But why do you think it's true?
I think it's true for a lot. I think exactly because of what we were talking about in terms of the silence separates you or connects you. I think that, in my opinion, when mind separates from body, we get more self-destructive. We get more destructive in general.
If we're more separate from our own selves, are we more separate from others as well?
I think so. I think that one does not go without the other. So as we're not as present in our body, for example, I would say that on some level, our attachment to capitalism and to money generation is actually a form of leaving our bodies. We think not about the river and how clean it is. We think about how much money we can make by dumping into it. We're thinking about other considerations, right? But like as we move away from our bodies, that we get more self-destructive. Well, as you move back through your body, especially when you've seen the disconnection that's possible, right? So like I got pulled apart. Right, yeah. I got stretched really thin through my traumatic experiences. And then as I come back and back through my body, that same silence that made me feel disconnected from people is what makes me feel so connected to people, that it's the same thing. And as you're more in your body, you do feel more connected to people. You don't think so about, you think about the importance of other life. You're here, it's beautiful. It's subtle. It's all one big thing. And so I think that the simple answer to your question is that as you move back into your body or more deeply into your body, it makes you in contact with the world more. And when you're part of the world, it's much harder to not feel compassion about the world.
You're part of the physical world, though, but there is some connection.
And there's another level of realizing that you're connected to the physical world. I mean, obviously, we're all moving our bodies through space. We're in the physical world. But then there's a realization that comes when you've been disconnected and start to bring your, what I'd call silence, or your mental energy back through your body, where you see how beautiful the connections are. And it makes you more compassionate, less willing to do violence, I think. Right. And so it's amazing. The observation, too, as just watch students that start with one type of go, when you're overcoming and trying to climb the mountain to get to the top with that willful overcoming story, you're much willing to see things as a means.
Right. Even other people.
And when you start going, wait, I mean, if we were to really, it would be really hard to have warfare actually happen if you actually thought about the human being you were killing, if you're actually connected as a human being to the person you're in combat with, that would be really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, like you, and when you realize that their mothers and daughters, whenever I hear of any trauma, I know of because of my experience, the impact that someone dying has on everybody. That's a father, that's a son, that's a whole bunch of human webs of interaction. When you start to feel that through your body and not just intellectually, it deepens your connection. And I think makes you over time become more compassionate. At least that's my hope.
You know, I also think the language around disability has been, well, it's been politically debated in recent years. And I mean, I have to say, I'm sitting here with you and your body is very alive and it seems to me to be very connected. You know, you're in a wheelchair, but you're animated. You have incredible energy. And I don't know, do you use that word disability for yourself? Do you think of yourself as disabled? And if you do, what does that mean?
I have a whole bunch of thoughts about that. I get tired of having the language have to be correct.
Yeah.
And I think the language is the first step of moving consciousness, so I tolerate it. you know. But when someone tells me that I can't call myself disabled or a paraplegic or something or whatever the word may be, I kind of want to look at them and go, wait, it's my experience.
And because it, and probably don't want you to use the word because it's uncomfortable for somebody
them.
Else. Yes.
Well, that's my point. You know, it's like that part of the languaging I'm a little bit impatient for, but I realize it's an attempt to bring more awareness to the issue that surrounds disability. But I think it brings too much morality around it. Like there's a right thing and wrong thing to say. And I think that that's not consciousness. That's just words.
Okay.
Right. So that's the level on that. But do I think of myself as disabled? I have to tell you, honestly, there are times even now, 27 plus years later, where I will see my shadow and be shocked. You know, like I'll look at it, it's in a wheelchair. It's like, wow, that's what I look like when I'm wheeling through the world. Mm. Like, I don't, but at the same time, I definitely am disabled. You know, like it's definitely, but my life force, and that's part of what Waking Through Story tries to open, is that life force isn't completely determined by your ability to flex muscles, that there's something here, and I don't know what it is, and I don't care if it's neurophysiologically explained, but there's a presence here that flows through us that isn't solely determined by the fact if I could stand up or not. And I've always felt that surge. And I also know that that connection was what made me such a good athlete as a little kid. It's like, you feel a free throw, you feel stuff. And it comes from your legs and it comes from your arms and it comes from unity. All that unity is still here, right? I just can't quite stand up, right? So,
you know, you describe in your book that at different times in your life and through all the operations and your initial injury and other injuries, you then at some point started to realize that healing could look like something different than being able to walk again. I mean, do you feel that you are healed?
I think my mind-body relationship continues to heal. That as I practice yoga and pay attention and be in love with the world, actually, it continues to heal. I have so much more presence. Before I started yoga, I really did feel like a floating upper torso. And like when I'd be talking here with you, I'd be more talking just with my upper body. You can still see it.
I feel like you're talking with your whole
body.
The
whole thing, man, it's moving through the whole thing. And that presence was not realized in me before I started yoga.
And you're saying that that presence is about your mind being connected to your physical.
And like I'm talking with you with my whole being. It's like yoga poured water on me and through me. And I was really dry and kind of tired before. And that there was so much more here that needed to just kind of be here, right? And so I practice yoga not just to become like really great at yoga poses. I practice yoga to feel this level of connection. That it is so much more connected than we think.
Is there a more defined or another spiritual aspect for you to the practice of yoga? Let me ask the question this way. The silence that we've talked about before, this inner silence that you feel you live with now, you engage, is that also another way to talk about the human spirit, or how do you think about the human spirit?
You know, anything that you don't know how to explain and want to call spirit to me is like a great, it's been a conceptual placeholder through time of whatever we don't quite understand, right? And so that is for sure part of it. I do think or feel, I mean, to talk it on another level for a second, I think the silence within us is what religion and politics and science have been competing for. Like literally,
okay.
There's been a competition in institutions for a very profound and powerful aspect of human being, right? And whichever one should win out, I don't even know. But that space, that dimension of us, I'll call it spirit. That sounds great. Mm. I just know it's here.
Right.
And if I just think that whether or not I can lift my leg is going to be the sole determinant of whether that space is here, I'm living in too small of a world. That it's not quite like that. it's not so determined. There's something about us that's kind of amorphous too in our presence. I think that's why some people are charismatic. Some people, you know, who knows?
Right.
In our language, it shows that we already kind of recognize this phenomena. There's something here. And cash it out however you want. But I'm just glad it's here.
Yeah. You also tell a lot of really intriguing stories in the book about dreams and premonitions. I mean, not necessarily incidents that you paid a lot of attention to at the time, but after the accident where your father died and your sister died and you were paralyzed, you saw there were stories that seemed to point towards that.
Yeah, you know, the things that happen, I don't know if the accident hadn't happened, we just would have forgot these things, but there are all sorts of strange things. I pronounced 20, let's say it was a Halloween, so 27 days before the accident, I pronounced to my almost beginning seventh grade girlfriend, we're just in that space, who had a brother who was a paraplegic, and she told me about him, and I pronounced, I'd rather be dead than in a wheelchair. I mean, there's one. My sister talked about dying right before she died. My brother had a dream that there was an accident. All these things that happen, like I don't know if there's, I don't necessarily mean that there's foreknowledge or premonition, but I think that when I ended up, one of the healing stories that I come with and believe in is that your life is gaining current. It's like a river gaining current. And there are things that are kind of telling you stuff. One of the lines that I use at the end in one of the chapters is feeling without knowing. That is our fate.
Right.
Right, and I really think there's something to that. Did I know what was going to happen to me? I remember a conversation with my father where he first introduced the notion of my own mortality to me, and I was only 10. And I didn't understand what was going on, but I felt something. I felt like somehow my life was going to have stuff in it. My mom has always felt that about her life, and you see her eyes, you can see it, that there's been that in photographs of her as a young woman. You can see it in her. Is that really true? I don't know. You know, death and trauma travel through your life with such stunning swiftness. You start to tell stories. They're healing stories. Does it help that maybe what was coming online for my family, does it help that we knew kind of and got tipped off in advance? I don't know. Kind of raises the hair on my back and goes like, wow. You know, there's a thing that my sister wrote, remember me as I do you, with all tenderness that is possible for one. She made 3 copies of that in the year before she died, and now one hangs in my office behind my back when I'm reading. It's like, 3? Mm. Like, what is that? I have no idea. But it makes me feel wonder about, I don't understand exactly what's going on, but it does seem like there was something coming, maybe, that we could kind of feel, but we never would have known unless it actually had happened.
Do you think when you tell those kinds of stories, do you find that other people have those kinds of stories?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It's hard to talk about those stories, though, because, they are mysterious and
hard to admit. Uh-huh. Right. And that's why I go out of my way to say I'm not saying anything about predestination or foreknowledge. I have no idea. I just know that these are stories. These are things that are in our family that happened and look what happened. I don't know. Are they connected? I don't know. But that's just the thing. I don't need to know. I don't need to know, is there really a quantifiable spirit that makes me be able to feel more present in my body? At that part of the story, I don't care. That's the particular story. I don't care. I just know human experience has it in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's important to just listen. Because I think when you listen to your own experience, because in a way, all I ever did with yoga was listen to what I actually experienced in my paralysis. Not the conception I got from other people, from the doctors, from whoever. Just listen and let it be whatever it is. So part of the hope of waking is listen to your own life. If you think it's telling you to go get a soda rather than not, I think you probably got a problem. Right, if you try to make that too particular. Mm-hmm. But if you listen to the general unfolding of your life, somehow it's moving a particular direction.
How old are you now?
40.
It does strike me that you make a lot of comments about aging. You seemed, I don't know if this was happening all the way through, but as you reflect on your story beginning in your teenage years, you see a lot of analogies, a lot of things you learn about living with paralysis, about healing. You see a connection between that and the way people in our society think about aging. Talk to me about that.
You know, it's funny. It started for me in the hospital, where I literally told people right after intensive care that I was 13 going on 41. And that all of a sudden here I am almost 41 again, and it's kind of weird. That's one of those things we don't want to admit. Uh-huh. You know, you feel a little bit of that. But that I had to grow up fast. My childhood innocence changed abruptly, radically right away. But so there's that. I've always, as a little brother, I'm the youngest in the family. I always kind of wanted to be older. You know, so I've always thought that there's something magical about age, which of course there isn't, but there is too. But also that, you know, my body's hard, was prematurely hard and full of a lot of pain. I have a lot of issues, pragmatic issues, living issues day to day that are associated with the body not functioning as well as they usually do. I was struck in the hospital when I was in rehabilitation, even at a 13-year-old, I was 13, most of the people in the rehab gym were older. You know, I was around and being, rehabilitation was happening with older people. Mm-hmm. And surely I was the sole pubescent boy in the rehab center, because I was too old for pediatrics. So I was always aware of some of the issues that I have are going to be mirrored as we age, that my body is sore and hurts and always has, mm-hmm. right? So that I think that got me thinking about age. But I also, you know, I have learned so much from people, and especially older people, and watching them and watching the kind of presence they have. You can feel their willingness to sit still differently. Like I can, and so I feel in me as I become more aware of what I'm calling the silence, I can feel it more in people who are older. I mean, they say in India that true spiritual life can't begin until you're 60. I think that tells you something about what happens, that the mind-body relationship has to tip towards this silence to be open enough to see.
And does that start to happen as our bodies become less powerful?
Or less
present.
We
have to let go of that somehow as our sole source of strength?
I think that as the relationship between mind and body starts to tip its balance, that things change.
You say at one point, I can't remember what context in your memoir, that you completely disagree when people say my body is failing me. I'm in my 40s too. You know, people start to say this after they're 40. It's your eyes or your knees, but you really are. You say that's absolutely wrong.
And I say that, and it's full of grief for me, because I took advantage of my body as a 13-year-old by leaving my body to absorb all the trauma that it did. And one of the lessons that I've learned is it was my body that kept me living. That your body, for as long as it possibly can, will be faithful to living. That's what it does.
I mean, even despite the fact that
it's
that
coming
there's
apart.
Decay that comes
it's because
with age.
My body didn't ask to get hammered and break and have its spine shredded and many bones broken. And it went, okay, let's regroup, let's go. And only a little part of my body didn't heal. Only, you know, an inch or two of my spinal cord was not able to regenerate. It went to work, right? And that's what it'll do. That's what it does. It might get confused. It might know how to grow the right cells, but I'm telling you, it's moving towards living for as long as it possibly can.
And how does that make you think about how we might approach, honor, or if we know that about our bodies, even as we age, even as there are things happening in them that we don't like, how might we live differently in that awareness?
Again, you know, there's a thing in yoga, it's called pranayama, it's yogic breathing. And you breathe in a yoga pose for the spaces, I believe this, for the spaces that you can't feel. You don't just breathe for the bicep that you can really flex. You are trying to get life force through the spaces you can't feel. When you do, your balance increases, your strength increases, your flexibility increases. I think that when you talk about in terms of honor, if that's the healing story you want to tell about honoring your body, but don't make that a moral insight, you know, like, oh, no, I better only eat this or not that,
right,
and get all caught up.
And that
up
is
in,
the other way we do
and
it,
And that's
too.
The other way we do it. We work in, we think that's a moral insight. So, I like grace, you know, honoring has more weight in it in some ways. Or responsibility to my body, that, boy, that doesn't inspire me at all.
You're saying be graceful with your body? Is that what you mean?
Or know that, that the places you don't feel in you are graceful. They're not loss. They're not absence. They're not, they're part of your strength, of your fiber. That it's not just, in a piece of wood, it's not just the grains of wood. It's the empty space and spaces between the grains of wood that make it strong. It's both. And so, you know, the world not only gets lighter and easier when you include more of yourself here, right? More, you house more space than your mind will ever know.
And how do you think about, deal with those parts of your body that you don't like what's happening to them, the skin that's aging, the knees that hurt. I mean, those are minor problems compared to the pain that you've...
Well, no, but you know, I'd like to say in every particular instance, I'm great at it. No, this is hard. This is like, this takes patience. This takes, you know, it takes showing up every day. I'd like to tell you there's a one magic insight and suddenly it's all easy. No, it's work like everything else. I know... I think more, I don't know, more deeply, but differently than most people, how much my body has absorbed and moved towards living still. So I look at, you know, I have places, skin on my body, you know, old pressure sores and old stuff that happened that you can see the skin is struggling to stay and hold, you know. I don't, so, oh, it's not holding, dang it. I feel like, man, it's working as hard as it can. You know, there's that type of feeling that I have now. And I didn't used to have that, you know. But, you know, looking at, rather than how your mind-body relationship or your being is moving away from life, instead looking at it as how it's staying connected to life. Again, I think healing stories are so important. Right there, you got a basic one right there. How are you going to see it? Are you leaving here? Is your presence changing as you leave here that allows for other things? Yeah, my body does not heal as well as it used to when I was 13. That's true. My physical body doesn't do it. But because of the compassion I can feel for my body, for others, something else is healing. Right. It may not just be the skin on my ankle that I wish would heal a little bit better.
You have a 6-year-old son. There's nothing in the world more embodied than a 6-year-old boy. Pure energy.
Yep.
Pure physicality. How did your son think about your body?
My body?
Yeah.
I was so worried about this before I was a parent. I thought that he would have more issues than he does. He likes the idea that he's going to be taller than me sooner.
Okay.
And he hasn't quite grasped that I'm actually almost
6 feet
tall.
Because you're in a wheelchair.
Right? Yeah. He doesn't quite get, and I keep, you know, he doesn't quite get that. So he likes that part. He always kind of measured himself against me. But one of the things I think is really important is you got to let your kids have their own victory over their parents. You know, like not just get their way, but like let them know that, yeah, you will be bigger than me. Let them know that it's coming towards him. But on the whole, Paul is amazing. There are a couple times where we've been in like on daddy and me days. There is one story that it was a relay race at like his nursery school, preschool, and I couldn't do it. And so it was like this kind of running down this mat and going through and coming back. And so he did it. I couldn't line up with him and do the relay with him. So the other dads and sons were doing it, but he did it on his own right down along the side and ran down and then came back and gave me a big high five, you know? And so he knows that I can't do all the things. But when he came back and high-fived me and went, hey, we did it anyway, it was like silence and love.
I think those are probably your last words. Let me look at my notes to see if there's anything out. And did you have, are there questions back there?
Yes, 1 second.
I like it to work when it just comes in.
Mm-hmm. That's why your interviews are so good.
I listen. That's my discipline.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Yeah. Good. Thank you for reminding me. Great thing about this is, well,
I know.
Ken is our editor and he has really high ethical standards, but we can have talk about something now and slip it in earlier if we don't want to ruin those last words. But
that's fine.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you this. You've learned so much, thought so much about the mind-body connection, and you've had this incredible process of physical trauma and healing, and through your yoga, you've learned more. I wonder how you think about where the medical profession is on knowing and applying what you know, and others know.
Others know
you're
for sure.
You're not a lone voice.
I just have a story that puts a human face on it.
Okay.
That's what's so different. I think a lot of wonderful things are happening. The whole integrative movement.
Integrative medicine movement
is happening. But what I think that ends up happening a little bit too much is that they think of complementary care as increasing the menu item. You know, like you can do antibiotics and maybe some acupuncture and whatever. And I think so much what I try to do, and I do speak to medical students and within healthcare, what I try to say is like, look, let's take seriously that it's a mind-body injury or a mind-body problem. And when you do that, your stories are treatment too. Because I got told some stories about the phantom feeling. I didn't get into the phantom feelings about in the sensations I was telling you about. They said that weren't real, compared it to an amputee's legs, right? Those were treatment. And what the way that I think that the medical model and doctors and nurses are approached, and not so much nurses, more doctors, is that there's a movement to, well, you need to treat the whole person and be, it's like it's a moral thing. They need to be real patient and have good patient, doctor-patient care. Like it's something, it's a moral imperative. I want to try to switch the footing of that and tell you, no, it's treatment. It is what, you know, stories and giving a good healing stories going out forward into their life, to people that have gone through severe trauma, those aren't just being nice to that person. That's part of their responsibility, them to figure out how to treat on that level. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's just psychology. I don't think it's just psychological and emotional adjustment that my mind-body relationship as a 13-year-old was imprinted by some well-intending stories that ended up keeping me out of my body.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I like to do when I talk about, you know, there's the integrative medicine stuff, that's all fantastic, and I want to help in whatever way I can. But I also want to get so we take seriously that fundamentally, depending on where you let spirit fall into the picture, we have a mind and we have a body. And nothing happens to one piece without happening to the other. That's part of the fallacy. But again, that we treat the physical body is I think a symptom of that overcoming story. We can control the physical body more.
Mm-hmm.
We can win there. We can get an antibiotic.
Messy and amorphous. And
yep, it's tangible,
quantified. Yeah.
And so doctors, when you tell them this, they get itchy. They get hives, man.
Yeah, you had this story about one of your. Maybe this was when you broke your leg, when you first started doing yoga and overstretching. You said, he listens to my reports of energetic sensation but does not consider believing them. I am judged to be a nice guy but also a new age yoga nut. It will cost me.
Yeah, and it did cost me.
And that's an easy vignette to imagine.
Yep. And part of what I believe is that it's going to take more patients like me. We're going to need more people, not just saying, oh, treat me nice because I'm a patient, but that have sensation, and they're getting better. I hear this now more and more in my medical care. Well, you know your body best. But they're kind of patting me on the head when they say that.
But they're right. You just need them to live into that
They need
sentence.
To actually take that serious.
Uh-huh.
And live
Believe
into
what they're
What a
saying.
Great line. Live yeah. into that sentence. That's mm-hmm. exactly what I need them to do. You know, and that's only going to come as there's a deepened appreciation of the mind-body connection. You know, we already know that 70% of all illness is psychosomatic. We already know these things, that depression is, you know, that back pain and depression. We already know this, but we don't know what to do with it. And so part of what I want to do is get out there and try to say, no, and use my story to go, no, this is true. We've got to figure out, just because we don't know how to deal with it, start there, work backwards. But that's how I do yoga, right? I do yoga backwards. I can feel the energy of the pose, the energy of the truth of a particular pose, and I work backwards towards the physical. On some level, I think there's an analogy here with medicine. They have to just posit this truth that they don't know how to deal with it. And then people are really smart. They'll figure it out and move backwards.
That's great. Yeah? Okay. Wonderful. That's great. So I got all the energy from you I needed.
I know. I saw.